8. The Law of Duality. In the long run, every market becomes a two-horse race. Early on, a new category is a ladder of many rungs. Gradually, the ladder becomes a two-rung affair. In batteries, it's Eveready and Duracell. In photographic film, it's Kodak and Fuji. In rental cars, it's Hertz and Avis. In mouthwash, it's Listerine and Scope. In hamburgers, it's McDonald's and Burger King. In sneakers, it's Nike and Reebok. In toothpaste, it's Crest and Colgate. When you take the long view of marketing, you find the battle usually winds up as a titanic struggle between two major players, usually the old reliable brand and the upstart. Back in 1969, there were three major brands of a certain product. The leader had about 60% of the market, the number two brand had a 25% share, and the number three brand had a 6% share. The rest of the market included either private label or minor brands. The law of duality suggests that these market shares are unstable. Furthermore, the law predicts that the leader will lose market share and number two will gain. 22 years later, the leader dropped down to 45% of the market, the number two brand has 40%, and number three has 3%. The products are Coca-Cola, Pepsi-Cola, and Royal Crown Cola, respectively, but the principles apply to brands everywhere. Look at the three long-distance telephone companies. AT&T has 65% of the market, MCI has 17%, and Sprint has 10%. Who will win and who will lose in the telephone wars? While the future is unknowable, Chapter 17, The Law of Unpredictability, a betting person would put his or her money on MCI. MCI has won the battle with Sprint for second place, so now MCI ought to become the upstart alternative to old, reliable AT&T. Sprint is probably feeling very comfortable on the third rung of the ladder. 9% doesn't sound like much, but it translates to $6 billion in annual sales, and the market has been growing rapidly. For the long term, however, Sprint is in serious trouble. Look what happened to Royal Crown Cola. Back in 1969, the Royal Crown Company revitalized its franchise system, 350 bottlers strong, and hired the former president of Rival Pet Foods and a veteran of both Coke and Pepsi. The company also retained Wells Rich Green, a high-powered New York advertising agency. "We're out to kill Coke and Pepsi," declared Mary Wells Lawrence, the agency's head, to the Royal Crown bottlers. "I hope you'll excuse the word, but we're really going out for the jugular." The only brand that got killed was Royal Crown. In a maturing industry, third place is a difficult position to be in. Take the domestic automobile industry. In spite of heroic measures undertaken by Lee Iacocca, Chrysler is in trouble. In the long run, marketing is a two-car race. Take video games. In the late 80s, the market was dominated by Nintendo with a 75% share. The two also-rans were Sega and NEC. Today, Nintendo and Sega are neck and neck, and NEC is way behind. In the long run, marketing is a two-game race. Time frames, however, can vary. The fast-moving video game market played itself out in two or three seasons. The long-distance telephone market might take two or three decades. Take the airline industry. American Airlines, with 20% of the market, got its nose out in front and will probably wind up as the Coca-Cola of the skies. The interesting battle is between Delta and United, tied at 18% apiece. One of these two will take off like Pepsi, the other is headed down with Royal Crown. In the long run, marketing is a two-airline race. Are these results preordained? Of course not. There are other laws of marketing that can also affect the results. Furthermore, your marketing programs can strongly influence your sales, provided they are in tune with the laws of marketing. When you're a weak number three, like Royal Crown, you aren't going to make much progress by going out and attacking the two strong leaders. What they could have done is carved out a profitable niche for themselves. Chapter 5, The Law of Focus. Knowing that marketing is a two-horse race in the long run can help you plan strategy in the short run. It often happens that there is no clear-cut number two. What happens next depends upon how skillful the contenders are. Take the laptop computer field. Toshiba is in first place with 21% of the market, but there are five companies in second place. Zenith, Compaq, NEC, Tandy, and Sharp each have between 8 and 10% of the market. It ought to be fun to watch six horses come around a turn where there's room for only two. Toshiba and who? Which one will finish second? What's especially tragic from the economy's point of view are the resources wasted in many high-visibility categories, like laptop computers. Currently, there are 130 laptop brands on the market. The law of duality will see to it that very few of these brands will be around in the 21st century. Look at the history of the automobile in the United States. In 1904, 195 different cars were assembled by 60 companies. Within the following 10 years, 531 companies were formed and 364 perished. By 1923, only 108 car makers remained. This number dropped to 44 by 1927. Today, Ford and General Motors dominate the domestic industry, with Chrysler's future in doubt. Successful marketers concentrate on the top two rungs. Jack Welch, the legendary chairman and CEO of General Electric, said recently, "Only businesses that are number one or number two in their markets could win in the increasingly competitive global arena. Those that could not were fixed, closed, or sold." It's this kind of thinking that built companies like Procter & Gamble into the powerhouses they are. In 32 of its 44 product categories in the United States, P&G commands the number one or number two brands. Early on, in a developing market, the number three or number four positions look attractive. Sales are increasing. New, relatively unsophisticated customers are coming into the market. These customers don't always know which brands are the leaders, so they pick ones that look interesting or attractive. Quite often, these turn out to be the number three or number four brands. As time goes on, however, these customers get educated. They want the leading brand, based on the naive assumption that the leading brand must be better. We repeat, the customer believes that marketing is a battle of products. It's this kind of thinking that keeps the two brands on top. They must be the best. They're the leaders. 9. The law of the opposite. If you're shooting for second place, your strategy is determined by the leader. In strength, there is weakness. Wherever the leader is strong, there is an opportunity for a would-be number two to turn the tables. Much like a wrestler uses his opponent's strength against him, a company should leverage the leader's strength into a weakness. If you want to establish a firm foothold on the second rung of the ladder, study the firm above you. Where is it strong? And how do you turn that strength into a weakness? You must discover the essence of the leader and then present the prospect with the opposite. In other words, don't try to be better, try to be different. It's often the upstart versus old reliable. Coca-Cola is a 100-year-old product. Only seven people in the history of the world have known the Coke formula, which is kept locked in a safe in Atlanta. Coca-Cola is the old, established product. However, using the law of the opposite, Pepsi-Cola reversed the essence of Coca-Cola to become the choice of a new generation, the Pepsi generation. When you look at customers in a given product category, there seem to be two kinds of people. There are those who want to buy from the leader, and there are those who don't want to buy from the leader. A potential number two has to appeal to the latter group. In other words, by positioning yourself against the leader, you take business away from all the other alternatives to number one. If old people drink Coke and young people drink Pepsi, there's nobody left to drink Royal Crown Cola. Yet, too many potential number two brands try to emulate the leader. This usually is an error. You must present yourself as the alternative. Time built its reputation on colorful writing. So Newsweek turned the idea around and focused on a straightforward writing style. We separate facts from opinions. In other words, Newsweek puts its opinions in the editorial columns, not in the news columns. Sometimes you need to be brutal. Scope, the good-tasting mouthwash, hung the medicine breath label on its Listerine competition. But don't simply knock the competition. The law of the opposite is a two-edged sword. It requires honing in on a weakness that your prospect will quickly acknowledge. One whiff of Listerine, and you know that your mouth would smell like a hospital. Then quickly twist the sword. Scope is the good-tasting mouthwash that kills germs. Also in the mouthwash field is an interesting example of the futility of trying to emulate the leader. In 1961, Johnson & Johnson introduced Micrin mouthwash, focusing on its scientific virtues. Within months, Micrin became the number two brand. But with its germ-fighting approach, Listerine was also a scientific brand. So in 1965, when Procter & Gamble introduced Scope, it had the opposite position to itself. Scope went on to become the number two mouthwash. By 1978, when Johnson & Johnson withdrew the product from the market, Micrin's share had fallen to 1%. When Beck's beer arrived in the United States, it had a problem. It couldn't be the first imported beer, that was Heineken, nor could it be the first German imported beer, that was Löwenbräu. It solved its problem by repositioning Löwenbräu. You've tasted the German beer that's the most popular in America. Now taste the German beer that's the most popular in Germany. Today, Beck's is the second largest selling European beer in America. When it comes to beer, Americans trust German mouths more than they do their own mouths. This is a rare example of overturning the law of leadership and manipulating perceptions in the mind. All this is academic today, since Löwenbräu is now brewed in America. As a product gets old, it often accrues some negative baggage. This is especially true in the medical field. Take aspirin, a product introduced in 1899. With thousands of medical studies conducted on aspirin, someone was bound to find flaws in the product. Sure enough, they found stomach bleeding, just in time for the 1955 launch of Tylenol. With all the stomach bleeding publicity, Tylenol quickly was able to set itself up as the alternative. "For the millions who should not take aspirin," said the Tylenol advertising. Today, Tylenol outsells aspirin and is the largest-selling single product in American drugstores. Stolichnaya was able to hang the label of fake Russian vodka on American vodkas such as Smirnoff, Samovar, and Wolfschmidt by simply pointing out that they came from places like Hartford, Connecticut, Shenley, Pennsylvania, and Lawrenceburg, Indiana. Stolichnaya comes from Leningrad, Russia, making it the real thing. There has to be a ring of truth about the negative if it is to be effective. One of the classic examples of hanging a negative on a competitor is an advertisement that Royal Dalton China ran about its main U.S. competitor. The headline said it all. Royal Dalton, the China of Stoke-on-Trent, England, versus Lennox, the China of Pomona, New Jersey. The ad exploited the fact that many people thought Lennox was an imported China. By repositioning Lennox where it really belonged, in Pomona, New Jersey, Royal Dalton was able to establish itself as the real English China. Reason? Most people have a hard time imagining craftsmen making fine white-bone china in a tacky-sounding place like Pomona, New Jersey. When the folks in England saw the ad, they howled with laughter. It turns out that Stoke-on-Trent is just as tacky as Pomona. Marketing is often a battle for legitimacy. The first brand that captures the concept is often able to portray its competitors as illegitimate pretenders. A good number two can't afford to be timid. When you give up focusing on number one, you make yourself vulnerable, not only to the leader, but to the rest of the pack. Take the sad story of Burger King in recent years. Times have been difficult for this number two in hamburgers. It has been through many management changes, new owners, and a parade of advertising agencies. It doesn't take much of a history review to see what went wrong. Burger King's most successful years came when it was on the attack. It opened with Have It Your Way, which twitted McDonald's mass manufacturing approach to hamburgers. Then it hit McDonald's with Broiling, Not Frying, and The Whopper Beats the Big Mac. All these programs reinforced the number two alternative position. Then, for some unknown reason, Burger King ignored the law of the opposite. It got timid and stopped attacking McDonald's. The world was introduced to Herb the Nerd, the best food for fast times, we do it the way you do it, you've got to break the rules, and on and on. It even started a program to attract little kids, the mainstay of McDonald's strength. This is no way to stay a strong number two. Burger King's sales per unit declined and have never returned to the level they were when it was on the attack. Burger King made the mistake of not taking the opposite tack. 10. The Law of Division. Over time, a category will divide and become two or more categories. Like an amoeba dividing in a petri dish, the marketing arena can be viewed as an ever-expanding sea of categories. A category starts off as a single entity, computers, for example. But over time, the category breaks up into other segments, mainframes, mini computers, workstations, personal computers, laptops, notebooks, pen computers. Like the computer, the automobile started off as a single category. Three brands, Chevrolet, Ford, and Plymouth, dominated the market. Then the category divided. Today, we have luxury cars, moderately priced cars, and inexpensive cars, full-size, intermediate, and compacts, sports cars, four-wheel drive vehicles, RVs, and minivans. In the television industry, ABC, CBS, and NBC once accounted for 90% of the viewing audience. Now we have network, independent, cable, pay, and public television, and soon we'll have in-store and interactive television. Beer started the same way. Today, we have imported and domestic beer, premium and popular priced beers, light, draft, and dry beers, even non-alcoholic beer. The law of division even affects countries. Witness the mess in Yugoslavia. In 1776, there were about 35 empires, kingdoms, countries, and states in the world. By World War II, the number had doubled. By 1970, there were more than 130 countries. Today, some 190 countries are generally recognized as sovereign nations. Look at the music field. It used to be classical and popular music. To stay on top of the popular music field, you could watch Your Hit Parade, which featured the top 10 hits of the week. Radio adopted the same idea with a top 40 format. Today, top 40 is falling apart because there isn't one list anymore. Billboard, the Bible of the music business, has 11 separate hit lists: classical, contemporary jazz, country, crossover, dance, Latin, jazz, pop, rap, rhythm and blues, and rock. And 11 leaders for the 11 categories. They recently included Itzhak Perlman, 4Play, Garth Brooks, Luciano Pavarotti, Michael Jackson, Mi Mayor Necesidad, Dave Grusin, Enya, Public Enemy, Vanessa Williams, and Bruce Springsteen. Each segment is a separate, distinct entity. Each segment has its own reason for existence, and each segment has its own leader, which is rarely the same as the leader of the original category. IBM is the leader in mainframes, DEC in minis, Sun in workstations, and so on. Instead of understanding this concept of division, many corporate leaders hold the naive belief that categories are combining. Synergy and its kissing cousin, the corporate alliance, are the buzzwords in the boardrooms of America. IBM, according to the New York Times, is poised to take advantage of the coming convergence of whole industries, including television, music, publishing, and computing. IBM's strongest suit, says The Times, in the expected convergence of cable and telephone networks with computer and television manufacturers, may be technology that it has developed to create extremely high-speed networks. See Chapter 20, The Law of Hype. It won't happen. Categories are dividing, not combining. Also, look at the much-touted category called financial services. In the future, according to the press, we won't have banks, insurance companies, stockbrokers, or mortgage lenders. We'll have financial services companies. It hasn't happened yet. Prudential, American Express, and others have fallen into the financial services trap. Customers don't buy financial services. They buy stocks or life insurance or bank accounts. And they prefer to buy each service from a different company. The way for the leader to maintain its dominance is to address each emerging category with a different brand name, as General Motors did in the early days with Chevrolet, Pontiac, Oldsmobile, Buick, and Cadillac, and recently with Geo and Saturn. Companies make a mistake when they try to take a well-known brand name in one category and use the same brand name in another category. A classic example is the fate that befell Volkswagen, the company that introduced the small car category to America. Its Beetle was a big winner that grabbed 67% of the imported car market in the United States. Volkswagen was so successful that it began to think it could be like General Motors and sell bigger, faster, and sportier cars. So it swept up whatever models it was making in Germany and shipped them all to the United States. But unlike GM, it used the same brand, Volkswagen, for all of its models. Different Volks for different folks, said the advertising, which featured five different models, including the Beetle, the 412 sedan, the Dasher, the Thing, and even a station wagon. Needless to say, the only thing that kept selling was the small thing, the Beetle. Well, Volkswagen found a way to fix that. It stopped selling the Beetle in the United States and started selling a new family of big, fast, expensive Volkswagens. Now you have the Vanagon, the Scirocco, the Jetta, the Golf GL, and the Cabriolet. It even built a plant in Pennsylvania to build these wondrous new cars. Unfortunately for Volkswagen, the small car category continued to expand, and since people couldn't buy a long-lasting economical VW, they shifted to Toyota, Honda, and Nissan. Today, Volkswagen's 67% share has shrunk to less than 4%. Volkswagen isn't some minor European brand like Saab or Alfa Romeo. Volkswagen is the largest selling automotive brand in Europe. The cars VW sells in the United States are the same as the ones it sells in Europe. Only the minds of the people buying them are different. In America, Volkswagen means small and ugly. Nobody here wants to buy a big, beautiful Volkswagen. Chapter 4, The Law of Perception. One of Volkswagen's competitors, Honda, decided to go upmarket. Rather than use the Honda name in the luxury car market, it introduced the Acura. It even took the expensive step of setting up separate Acura dealerships to avoid confusion with Honda. The Acura became the first Japanese luxury car in the United States, where today, Honda sells many more Acuras than Volkswagen sells Volkswagens. Honda now has the leading brand in two categories. What keeps leaders from launching a different brand to cover a new category is the fear of what will happen to their existing brands. General Motors was slow to react to the super premium category that Mercedes-Benz and BMW established. One reason was that a new brand on top of Cadillac would enrage GM's Cadillac dealers. Eventually, GM tried to take Cadillac upmarket with the $54,000 Allante. It bombed. Why would anyone spend that kind of money on a so-called Cadillac, since their neighbors would probably think they paid only $30,000 or so? No prestige. A better strategy for General Motors might have been to put a new brand into the Mercedes market. They might have brought back the classic LaSalle. Timing is also important. You can be too early to exploit a new category. Back in the 50s, the Nash Rambler was America's first small car. But American Motors didn't have either the courage or the money to hang in there long enough for the category to develop. It's better to be early than late. You can't get into the prospect's mind first unless you're prepared to spend some time waiting for things to develop. 11. The Law of Perspective. Marketing effects take place over an extended period of time. Is alcohol a stimulant or a depressant? If you visit almost any bar and grill on a Friday night after work, you'd swear that alcohol was a stimulant. The noise and laughter are strong evidence of alcohol's stimulating effects. Yet at 4 in the morning, when you see a few happy hour customers sleeping it off in the streets, you'd swear that alcohol is a depressant. Chemically, alcohol is a strong depressant. But in the short term, by depressing a person's inhibitions, alcohol acts like a stimulant. Many marketing moves exhibit the same phenomenon. The long-term effects are often the exact opposite of the short-term effects. Does a sale increase a company's business or decrease it? Obviously, in the short term, a sale increases business, but there's more and more evidence to show that sales decrease business in the long term by educating customers not to buy at regular prices. Aside from the fact that you can buy something for less, what does a sale say to a prospect? It says that your regular prices are too high. After the sale is over, customers tend to avoid a store with a sale reputation. To maintain volume, retail outlets find they have to run almost continuous sales. It's not unusual to walk down a retail block and find a dozen stores in a row with sale signs in their windows. Have the automobile rebate programs increased sales? The rise of auto rebates have coincided with a decline in auto sales. U.S. vehicle sales have declined for 5 straight years in a row. The largest furniture company in the New York City area, Siemens, has been running a sale every week. Recently, Siemens went bankrupt. There is no evidence that couponing increases sales in the long run. Many companies find they need a quarterly dose of couponing to keep sales on an even keel. Once they stop couponing, sales drop off. In other words, you keep those coupons rolling out not to increase sales, but to keep sales from falling off if you stop. Couponing is a drug. You continue to do it because the withdrawal symptoms are just too painful. Any sort of couponing, discounts, or sales tends to educate consumers to buy only when they can get a deal. What if a company never started couponing in the first place? In the retail field, the big winners are the companies that practice everyday low prices. Companies like Walmart and Kmart, and the rapidly growing warehouse outlets. Yet almost everywhere you look, you see yo-yo pricing. The airlines and the supermarkets are two examples. Recently, however, Procter & Gamble made a bold move to establish uniform pricing, which could become the start of a trend. In everyday life, there are many examples of short-term gains and long-term losses, crime being a typical example. If you rob a bank for $100,000 and wind up spending 10 years in jail, you either made $100,000 for a day's work or $10,000 a year for 10 years of labor. It depends on your point of view. Inflation can give an economy a short-term jolt, but in the long run, inflation leads to recession. The nuts in Brazil haven't figured this out yet. In the short term, overeating satisfies the psyche, but in the long term, it causes obesity and depression. In many other areas of life, spending money, taking drugs, having sex, the long-term effects of your actions are often the opposite of the short-term effects. Why then is it so hard to comprehend that marketing effects take place over an extended period of time? Take line extension. In the short term, line extension invariably increases sales. The beer industry clearly illustrates this effect. In the early 70s, Miller High Life was barreling along with sales increases averaging 27% a year. Miller's success was fueled by Miller Time, a blue-collar campaign focused on rewarding yourself at the end of the day with a Miller beer. Then Miller got greedy, and in 1974 introduced Miller Lite, a brilliant concept, Chapter 2, The Law of the Category, buried under a line-extended name. In the short term, the two Millers could coexist, the blue-collar beer, High Life, and the yuppie beer, Lite. But in the long term, line extension was bound to undermine one or the other brand. The high-water mark for Miller High Life was 1979, 5 years after the introduction of Miller Lite. In those 5 years, Miller High Life's annual sales almost tripled, from 8.6 million to 23.6 million barrels. This was the short-term effect of line extension. The long-term effect was grim. From a high of 23.6 million barrels in 1979, Miller High Life declined 13 years in a row to just 5.8 million barrels in 1991. And the decline is bound to continue. Nor has Miller Lite been immune to the ravages of line extension. In 1986, the brewer introduced Miller Genuine Draft. The brand took because it was the first beer in a new category. Unfortunately, the brand also carried the Miller name. Listen to the next chapter, The Law of Line Extension. History repeats itself. 5 years later, Miller Lite peaked in sales and then started to decline. Once started, the decline is almost impossible to stop. Unless you know what to look for, it's hard to see the effects of line extension, especially for managers focused on their next quarterly report. If a bullet took 5 years to reach a target, very few criminals would be convicted of homicide. The same thing that happened to Miller happened to Michelob. 3 years after the introduction of Michelob Lite, regular Michelob peaked in sales and then declined 11 years in a row. Today, the four Michelob flavors combined, regular, light, dry, and classic dark, sell 25% fewer barrels than Michelob alone did in 1978, the year Michelob Lite was introduced. The same thing happened to Coors. The introduction of Coors Light caused the collapse of Coors Regular, which today sells one-fourth of what it used to. Even the King is down. After annual sales increases, stretching back to the end of Prohibition, Budweiser has been slipping the last 3 years in a row. The cause? Bud Light. You might be thinking that Miller, Coors, and Anheuser-Busch had to line extend because light beer has taken over the market. If you believe what you read in the papers, you'd think that everyone is drinking light beer. Not true. Today, 18 years after the introduction of Miller Lite, light beer still accounts for only 31% of the beer market. In other areas of marketing, the short-term, long-term line extension effects occur much more rapidly. Coca-Cola Close were introduced by Mirjani in 1985. 2 years later, wholesale volume reached $250 million. The following year, the line dried up virtually overnight, saddling Mirjani with millions of dollars worth of inventory. What happened to Coca-Cola Close also happened to Donald Trump. At first, the Donald was successful. Then he branched out and put his name on anything the banks would lend him money for. What's a Trump? A hotel, three casinos, two condominiums, one airline, one shopping center. Fortune magazine called Trump an investor with a keen eye for cash flow and asset values, a smart marketer, a cunning wheeler-dealer. Time and Newsweek put the Donald on their covers. Today, Trump is $1.4 billion in debt. What made him successful in the short term is exactly what caused him to fail in the long term. Line extension. It looks easy, but marketing is not a game for amateurs. 12. The Law of Line Extension. There's an irresistible pressure to extend the equity of the brand. If violating any of our laws was a punishable offense, a large portion of corporate America would be in jail. By far, the most violated law in our book is the law of line extension. What's even more diabolical is that line extension is a process that takes place continuously, with almost no conscious effort on the part of the corporation. It's like a closet or a desk drawer that fills up with almost no effort on your part. One day, a company is tightly focused on a single product that is highly profitable. The next day, the same company is spread thin over many products and is losing money. Take IBM. Years ago, when IBM was focused on mainframe computers, the company made a ton of money. Today, IBM is into everything and barely breaking even. In 1991, for example, IBM's revenues were $65 billion, yet the company wound up losing $2.8 billion. That's almost $8 million a day. In addition to selling mainframe computers, IBM markets personal computers, pen computers, workstations, mid-range computers, software, networks, telephones, you name it. IBM even tried to get into the home computer market with the PC Junior. Along the way, IBM dropped millions on copiers, sold to Kodak, ROM, sold to Siemens, satellite business systems, shut down, the Prodigy Network, limping along, SAA, TopView, Office Vision, and OS2. When a company becomes incredibly successful, it invariably plants the seeds for its future problems. Take Microsoft, the most successful company in the software field. Even though the company is 1/50th the size of General Motors, Microsoft's stock is worth more than GM's. What is Microsoft's strategy? In a word, more. Microsoft Corporation said it is aggressively seeking the dominant share in every major software applications category in the personal computer field, said the Wall Street Journal recently. Michael Maples, senior vice president of Microsoft's applications division, suggested that Microsoft might be able to achieve as much as 70% share in every major applications category, continued the journal. Whom does that sound like? Sounds like IBM. Microsoft is setting itself up as the next IBM, with all the negative implications the name suggests. Microsoft is the leader in personal computer operating systems, but it trails the leaders in each of the following major categories. Spreadsheets, Lotus is the leader. Word processing, WordPerfect is the leader. And business graphics, Harvard Graphics from SPC Software Publishing is the leader. Microsoft keeps puffing itself up by expanding into new categories, such as pen computers. Recently, Microsoft bought Fox Software for $170 million in order to get into the database software field. What do you bet the company kills the Fox and changes it to Microsoft? There are ominous signs of softness in Microsoft's strategy. The Economist reported in early 1992, Mr. Gates is putting together a range of products based on a common core of technology that will compete across virtually the whole of the software industry, from big computers to small ones, and from operating systems in the information engine room to graphics programs that draw every picture for executives. Nobody in the software industry has yet managed a venture of that complexity, though IBM has tried and failed. When you try to be all things to all people, you inevitably wind up in trouble. I'd rather be strong somewhere, said one manager, than weak everywhere. In a narrow sense, line extension involves taking the brand name of a successful product, e.g. A1 steak sauce, and putting it on a new product you plan to introduce, e.g. A1 poultry sauce. It sounds so logical. We make A1, a great sauce that gets the dominant share of the steak business, but people are switching from beef to chicken. So let's introduce a poultry product. And what better name to use than A1? That way people will know the poultry sauce comes from the makers of that great steak sauce, A1. But marketing is a battle of perception, not product. In the mind, A1 is not the brand name, but the steak sauce itself. "Would you pass me the A1?" asks the diner. Nobody replies, "A1 what?" In spite of an $18 million advertising budget, the A1 poultry launch was a dismal failure. There are as many ways to line extend as there are galaxies in the universe, and new ways get invented every day. In the long run, and in the presence of serious competition, line extensions almost never work. Creating flavors is a popular way to try to grab market share. More flavors, more share. Sounds right, but it doesn't work. Back in 1978, when 7-Up was simply the lemon-lime Uncola, it had a 5.7% share of the soft drink market. Then the company added 7-Up Gold, Cherry 7-Up, and assorted diet versions. Today, 7-Up's share is down to 2.5%. Wherever you look, you'll find line extensions, which is one reason why stores are choked with brands. There are 1,300 shampoos, 200 cereals, 250 soft drinks. Invariably, the leader in any category is the brand that is not line extended. Take baby food, for example. Gerber has 72% of the market, way ahead of Beechnut and Heinz, the two line extended brands. In spite of evidence that line extensions don't work, companies continue to pump them out. Here are some examples. Ivory soap, Ivory shampoo, Lifesavers candy, Lifesavers gum, Bic lighters, Bic pantyhose, Chanel, Chanel for men, Tanqueray gin, Tanqueray vodka, Coors beer, Coors water, Heinz ketchup, Heinz baby food, USA Today, USA Today on TV, Adidas running shoes, Adidas cologne, Pierre Cardin clothing, Pierre Cardin wine, Levi's blue jeans, Levi's shoes, Colgate Palmolive. We want to leverage our basic core brands and trade on our brand names to extend into new categories. Ed Fogarty, President. Campbell Soup Company. Leveraging and extending high-quality repeat purchase brand names is always preferred over launching a new name. David W. Johnson, CEO. Del Monte. We're dedicated to the single brand concept. We're going to keep extending the Del Monte name into new areas. Ewan McDonald, President. Ultra SlimFast. There will be soups, pastas, salad dressings, soda, fruit juices, and a new thicker diet drink called Ultra SlimFast Plus. Daniel Abraham, Chairman. Good luck and good night, Mr. Abraham. Why does top management believe that line extension works in spite of the overwhelming evidence to the contrary? One reason is that while line extension is a loser in the long term, it can be a winner in the short term. Chapter 11, The Law of Perspective. Management is also blinded by an intense loyalty to the company or brand. Why else would PepsiCo have introduced Crystal Pepsi in spite of the failures of Pepsi Light and Pepsi AM? More is less. The more products, the more markets, the more alliances a company makes, the less money it makes. Full speed ahead in all directions seems to be the call from the corporate bridge. When will companies learn that line extension ultimately leads to oblivion? Less is more. If you want to be successful today, you have to narrow the focus in order to build a position in the prospect's mind. What does IBM stand for? It used to stand for mainframe computers. Today, it stands for everything, which means it stands for nothing. Why is Sears Roebuck in trouble? Because the company tried to be all things to all people. Sears was big in hard goods, so it went into soft goods and then fashion. The company even hired Cheryl Teagues. Do fashion models really buy their miniskirts at Sears? In the conventional view, a business strategy usually consists of developing an all-encompassing vision. In other words, What concept or idea is big enough to hold all of a company's products and services on the market today, as well as those that are planned for the future? In the conventional view, strategy is a tent. You stake out a tent big enough so it can hold everything you might possibly want to get into. IBM has erected an enormous computer tent. Nothing in the computer field, today or in the future, will fall outside the IBM tent. This is a recipe for disaster. As new companies, new products, new ideas invade the computer arena, IBM is going to get blown away. You can't defend a rapidly growing market like computers, even if you are a financial powerhouse like IBM. From a strategic point of view, you have to be much more selective, picking and choosing the area in which to pitch your tent. Strategically, General Motors is in the same boat as IBM. GM is into anything and everything on wheels: sedans, sports cars, cheap cars, expensive cars, trucks, minivans, even electric cars. So what is GM's business strategy? If it runs on the road or off the road, we'll chase it. For many companies, line extension is the easy way out. Launching a new brand requires not only money, but also an idea or concept. For a new brand to succeed, it ought to be the first in a new category, Chapter 1, The Law of Leadership, or the new brand ought to be positioned as an alternative to the leader, Chapter 9, The Law of the Opposite. Companies that wait until a new market has developed often find these two leadership positions already preempted, so they fall back on the old reliable line extension approach. The antidote for line extension is corporate courage, a commodity in short supply. 13. The Law of Sacrifice. You have to give up something in order to get something. The law of sacrifice is the opposite of the law of line extension. If you want to be successful today, you should give something up. There are three things to sacrifice: product line, target market, and constant change. First, the product line. Where is it written that the more you have to sell, the more you sell? The full line is a luxury for a loser. If you want to be successful, you have to reduce your product line, not expand it. Take Emery Air Freight. Emery was in the air freight services business. Anything you wanted to ship, you could ship via Emery. Small packages, large packages, overnight service, delayed service. From a marketing point of view, what did Federal Express do? It concentrated on one service: small packages overnight. Today, Federal Express is a much bigger company than Emery. The power of the sacrifice for Federal Express was being able to put the word overnight in the mind of the prospect. When it absolutely, positively had to be there overnight, you would call Federal Express. Then what did Federal Express do? The company did the same thing Emery did. It threw away its overnight position by buying Tiger International's Flying Tiger cargo line for $880 million. Now, Federal Express is a worldwide air cargo company without a worldwide position. In just 21 months, Federal Express lost $1.1 billion in its international operations. Marketing is a game of mental warfare. It's a battle of perceptions, not products or services. In the mind of the prospect, Federal Express is the overnight company. Federal Express owns the overnight position. When the market turned international, Federal Express faced a classic marketing dilemma. Should it try to take a domestic name into the international field, or should it create a new worldwide name? Furthermore, how should it deal with DHL, the company that got into the international field first? It's bad enough that Federal Express walked away from the overnight idea. What's worse is that it didn't replace the idea with a new one. EverReady was the longtime leader in batteries, but new technology arrived, as it does in most industries. The first technology to change the battery business was the heavy-duty battery. What would you call your heavy-duty battery if you had the number one name in batteries? You'd probably call it the Eveready heavy-duty battery, which is what Eveready did. Then the alkaline battery arrived. Again, Eveready called its alkaline battery the Eveready alkaline battery. It seemed to make sense. Then, P.R. Mallory introduced a line of alkaline batteries only. Furthermore, the company gave the line a better name, Duracell. The power of the sacrifice for Duracell was in being able to put the long-lasting battery idea in the mind of the prospect. Duracell lasts twice as long as Eveready, said the advertising. Eveready was forced to change the name of its alkaline battery to the Energizer, but it was too late. Duracell had already become the leader in the battery market. The world of business is populated by big, highly diversified generalists and small, narrowly focused specialists. If line extension and diversification were effective marketing strategies, you'd expect to see the generalists riding high. But they're not. Most of them are in trouble. The generalist is weak. Take Kraft, for example. Everybody thinks Kraft is a strong brand name. In jellies and jams, Kraft has 9% of the market. But Smucker's has 35%. Kraft means everything. But with a name like Smucker's, it has to be jelly or jam because that's all Smucker's makes. In mayonnaise, Kraft has 18% of the market, but Hellmann's has 42%. Kraft does have a leading brand in terms of market share. However, its name isn't Kraft, it's Philadelphia. Philadelphia brand cream cheese has 70% of the cream cheese market. Take the retail industry. Which retailers are in trouble today? The department stores. And what's a department store? A place that sells everything. That's a recipe for disaster. Kempo, L.J. Hooker, and Gimbel's all wound up in bankruptcy court. Ames department stores filed for bankruptcy. Hills department stores filed for bankruptcy. Macy's, the owner of the world's largest store, filed for bankruptcy. Interstate department stores also went bankrupt, so the company looked at the books and decided to focus on the only product it made money on, toys. As long as Interstate was going to focus on toys, it decided to change its name to Toys R Us. Today, Toys R Us does 20% of the retail toy business in the country, very profitably too. In its last fiscal year, Toys R Us made $326 million on sales of $5.5 billion. Many retail chains are successfully patterning themselves on the Toys R Us formula, a narrow focus with in-depth stock. Staples, office supplies, and Blockbuster Video are two recent examples. In the retail field generally, the big successes are the specialists. The Limited, upscale clothing for working women. The Gap, casual clothing for the young at heart. Benetton, wool and cotton clothing for young swingers. Victoria's Secret, sexy undergarments. Foot Locker, athletic shoes. Banana Republic, safari wear. When a clothing chain with a name like Banana Republic can be successful, you know we live in the age of the specialist. Let's discuss the second sacrifice, target market. Where is it written that you have to appeal to everybody? Take the cola field. Coca-Cola got into the prospect's mind first and built a powerful position. In the late 50s, for example, Coke outsold Pepsi more than 5-1. What could Pepsi-Cola do to go against Coke's powerful position? In the early 60s, Pepsi-Cola finally developed a strategy based on the concept of sacrifice. The company sacrificed everything except the teenage market. Then it brilliantly exploited this market by hiring its icons, Michael Jackson, Lionel Richie, Don Johnson. Within one generation, Pepsi closed the gap. Today, it is only 10% behind Coca-Cola in total U.S. cola sales. In the supermarket, Pepsi-Cola actually outsells Coca-Cola. In spite of Pepsi-Cola's success, however, the pressure for enlarging the tent is always present. Recently, it succumbed to temptation. According to Advertising Age, Pepsi-Cola Company has outgrown the Pepsi generation. In a major marketing shift, flagship Pepsi will be pitched as the soft drink for the masses. Gotta have it is Pepsi's new theme. The advertising shows older people like Yogi Berra and Regis Philbin drinking Pepsi. The one drawback of Pepsi advertising in the past has been a little too much focus on youth, says Phil Dusenberry of Pepsi's ad agency BBDO. We could have made greater gains had we expanded our horizons to catch a wider net and catch more people. According to Fortune magazine, Coca-Cola is the world's most powerful trademark. When an also-ran like Pepsi-Cola develops a narrowly focused strategy that puts it within an eyelash of the leader, why would it change its powerful strategy? Why indeed? There seems to be an almost religious belief that the wider net catches more customers, in spite of many examples to the contrary. Take Budweiser, for example. When we go out to develop a plan for Budweiser, we have to cover everybody above 21 years of age, whether they're male, female, black, white, says August Bush IV. Look at cigarette advertisements, especially old cigarette ads. They invariably show both a man and a woman. Why? In an age when most smokers were men, cigarette manufacturers wanted to broaden their market. We got the men, let's go out and get the women too. So what did Philip Morris do? It narrowed the focus to men only. And then it narrowed the focus even more to a man's man, the cowboy. The brand was called Marlboro. Today, Marlboro is the largest selling cigarette in the world. In the United States, Marlboro is the largest selling cigarette among men and women. The target is not the market. That is, the apparent target of your marketing is not the same as the people who will actually buy your product. Even though Pepsi-Cola's target was the teenager, the market was everybody. The 50-year-old guy who wants to think he's 29 will drink the Pepsi. The target of Marlboro advertising is the cowboy, but the market is everybody. Do you know how many cowboys are left in America? Very few. They've all been smoking Marlboros. Finally, the third sacrifice. Constant change. Where is it written that you have to change your strategy every year at budget review time? If you try to follow the twists and turns of the market, you are bound to wind up off the road. The best way to maintain a consistent position is not to change it in the first place. People Express had a brilliant, narrow position to start with. It was the no-frills airline that flew to no-frills cities at no-frills prices. People used to get on a People Express plane and say, "Where are we going?" They didn't care, as long as it was cheap enough. What did People Express do after it became successful? It tried to be all things to all people. It invested in new equipment, like 747s. It started to fly the heavily traveled routes to places like Chicago and Denver, not to mention Europe. It bought Frontier Airlines. It added frills, like first-class sections. People Express promptly lost altitude and only escaped bankruptcy court by selling itself to Texas Air, which did it for them. White Castle, on the other hand, has never changed its position. A White Castle today not only looks the same as a White Castle did 60 years ago, it also sells the same frozen sliders at unbelievably low prices. Would you believe the average White Castle does more than $1 million a year in revenues? That's more than Burger King, and not too far behind McDonald's. Good things come to those who sacrifice.
Thank you for listening to this episode of our podcast. We'll be really thankful if you support us by clicking the link in the description so that we continue to create amazing content for you.